Welcome to the University of Michigan Press podcast, featuring interviews with University of Michigan Press authors.
Whether he is discussing the way cell phones have altered physical intimacy and introduced new verb forms, or the way Emily Dickinson's mysteries are more clearly revealed in French translation, Kazem Ali is at once clear and complex, rigorous and charming, accessible and demanding. In Orange Alert, Ali discusses contemporary poetry in relation to other art forms and to contemporary television, film, and electronic media, including the internet, YouTube, and Facebook. He shines a light on the intersections between cultures in these essays and the craft of poetry, offering a hand to poets either geographically or metaphorically outside the mainstream of Western culture. Kazem Ali is the author of two books of poetry, The Far Mosque and The 40th Day, two novels, Quinn's Passage and The Disappearance of Seth, and a memoir, Bright Felon, Autobiography in Cities. He is assistant professor of creative writing at Oberlin College. He has been a regular columnist for American Poetry Review. Welcome, Kazem.
Thank you.
Reading Write Something on My Wall, I'm struck by how inward-looking or interior Emily Dickinson and Battlestar Galactica's Starbuck are. If Emily Dickinson had a Facebook page, how would her work have changed? Could she and Starbuck, either gender's version, ever friend each other?
Well, I think probably if Emily Dickinson had a Facebook page, I think she would be one of those people who never really put in their status updates like what was happening in their day, but they would be putting in all these sort of mysterious quotes or links to news stories or little opinions about things that were happening in the news, because she was very engaged, of course, with the external world. Contrary to the myth, of course, she was a voracious reader. She read the newspaper. She was very up on the current events. She had a Facebook page or a version of it, what you had at the time, and she had very few friends in that, you know, there's some people have like 20 friends on Facebook or something like that. But she was reaching out all the time. She was sending poems to her sister-in-law, Susan, who lived next door. Sometimes the same day they were written, she was sending them over, and Susan would send them right back with comments and thoughts, and these are all in the letters of Emily Dickinson, and you can watch Emily Dickinson incorporate Susan's suggestions into the next version. So she was a very social and engaged poet. She was just extremely choosy about who she would include. And in a way, if you read in a certain way, you can see her relationship with Thomas Higginson has flipped, not him as the mentor who ignored her, but almost like he did not quite meet her standards in terms of the distance that develops and the way that she addresses him and the way she positions herself in relationship to him that changes throughout her correspondence with him. It's really interesting. I think she was an inveterate letter writer, so I think she would have really dug Facebook in terms of as a way of staying in careful touch with people. In terms of Emily Dickinson and Melville Starbuck and Galactica Starbuck, I think it's a wonderful question because these two characters, these two Starbucks are flips of each other. They're each put in a position where they have a particular religious, you know, quote-unquote religious convictions, strong religious convictions that are leading them in a certain way away from the prescribed social order. Now, Melville Starbuck is unable to make that final leap when he's standing over Ahab, who's asleep. He has the gun. He knows that he can finish it. He can save everyone. But he can't. He fundamentally can't make that final action. Whereas our Battlestar Galactica Starbuck, perhaps because of her gender queerness, her crazy passion, her obsession with questions of the nature of spirit and existence and reality of death, all questions which also obsessed Emily Dickinson, that Galactica Starbuck is able to make that leap and do, you know, the insane thing, in other words. So like Emily, Cara Thrace was, you know, constantly reinventing herself, completely unafraid to turn her back on what the prescribed social order was thinking. And in the end, finally, just like Emily Dickinson, the book Battlestar Galactica Starbuck Cara Thrace was beyond anyone's understanding of the nature of character, beyond the grasp of the intellect, and finally, at the end, beyond the grasp of death.
Please talk a little bit about how you incorporate everyday experiences and observations into your work.
Well, everything really is from everyday experiences. I mean, in the essay that I wrote in the book called The Architecture of Loneliness, I was traveling in Andalusia in Spain, and I was reading Yanis Ritsos, who's a Greek poet, and I was writing about the architecture of southern Spain, and Rizzo says, the book that I was reading was his last book that he wrote at the very end of his life, and I just wrote about his intense loneliness and as it related to what these mosques that I was seeing. And then when we got to Cordoba, the second day we were there, we had just seen the great mosque in Cordoba that I write about in that essay, The Architecture of Loneliness. And I was in the shower, and then I came out of the shower. And on the national news, there was a news story that Mahmoud Darwish had passed away. And so immediately the ghost of Darwish came into the essay. I mean, now that's a country, right, where the morning news covers the death of a poet, you know, up an Arab poet, a Palestinian poet. So that sort of like changed the essay itself. I mean, that just took from that. When I was in France, I was reading Beckett, and I was reading Beckett in French, and then I was reading Beckett in English, and I sort of realized, like, oh, you know, and this was a book that Beckett himself had translated, a book in English called Ill Seen, Ill Said. And as I was reading the two versions, I thought, this is actually not really the same. He translated it, but he changed it. It's a different book, you know. And that same day, my family, my French family, my uncle, my mom's cousin married a French woman, so I have a family in France as well. We all went to Auvers-sur-Oise, which is where Van Gogh painted the famous church with the blue sky and everything. And so I had the postcard of the church, and then there was the church in front of me, the actual church. And then I had this French Beckett and this English Beckett, and I was like, you know, and all of that kind of came into my mind and sort of made me think about, well, what is reality and what are real things? And so then I wrote that essay called Ersatz Everything. And then I came home from France and read Jean Baudrillard, who I had never read before. And I read Paul Virilio, who I had never read before. And I thought, oh, these guys basically explained everything that I was talking about. Why didn't anybody tell me that I had to read them, you know? And then I wrote the follow-up essay to Ersatz Everything was Write Something on My Wall. So then that actually sort of picked up all those ideas, but through Baudrillard and Virilio came into that essay because I hadn't read them before. I didn't know, you know?
How fantastic. Okay, so we learned from Poetry is Dangerous about your experience when a box of recycled poetry manuscripts accidentally closes down an institution of higher education because an authority figure decides you're a terrorist. Now, if you and the ROTC person, in your case, had a beer with Obama, what would you collectively talk about? I mean, how would you talk with that ROTC person about race and hyperreaction to recycling?
Yeah, well, you know, the funny part about all of the whole situation was that he was not an authority figure. He was a kid, you know. And he reacted in a certain way, but he himself is responding to a set of social circumstances, the training he's received, and everything in the air, you know? I mean, in New York City, everywhere you go, there's all these signs that say, in the subway and everything, if you see something, say something. So I'm not downplaying the idea of danger, because I know that things have happened, but we have definitely, lots of things have happened, but we have definitely chosen to live in a state of hyper tension, basically, and to play on that and to, I believe, prey on that in a sense, to keep everyone nervous, to keep everyone scared, to keep everyone skittish, report whatever you see. I mean, this is not good for us. It's not good for, you know, open society. It's not good for the democracy. You know, in a way, like, we have been defeated because we have been decided to, you know, just go the way of war and anger and punishment and, you know, kill everyone until no one is left alive moving, basically. It's completely scary, you know. And the kid, the RA, the young man in question felt terrible after everything came out and my essay came out. He was apparently very upset. And I was communicating with the president of Shippensburg University, and I was saying, you know, look, we need to talk about that, because Shippensburg did not release to the media that it was me, that I was a faculty member. They just said there was a mistake that was made, but they didn't mean their mistake. They meant my, or the cadet's mistake. They meant my mistake in terms of not being sensitive. I mean, I was told as much, you know? And so I was trying to talk to the president of the university, saying, like, you know, look, we need to, maybe we should address this. What if I talk to the ROTC kids about profiling and, you know, let's be reasonable. And he, you know, he had just become president, so maybe he felt like he had something to prove. But he was saying to me stuff like, well, you know, Kazem, you know, I've been talking to these guys who come back from Iraq, and they say that IED, it can be anything. It can be in a boot. It can be in a, you know, in a suitcase. And I was completely flabbergasted. You know, I said, well, we're not in Baghdad right now. We're not in New York City. We're in the middle of the, you know, countryside, Shippensburg, small place, you know. Yeah, up the road is the Carlisle, the Army War College is up the road, but maybe that would be more of a, if somebody was interested in doing some disruptive activity than, you know, this quiet, sleepy little hamlet. But everybody wants to get in on the action of being, you know, the next terrorist target. It's really sad in a way. And so when I was talking to him about wanting to meet with them, apparently this ROTC kid who had been really upset, his RA sat down with him and stayed up with him all night or something, talking to him, saying, you did the right thing, you did the right thing. And so then the RA wrote the president an email saying, some of us support this guy, and we would rather be safe than sorry and all that. And so the president forwarded that email to me and said, you know, just so you know, there's another side of the story. Before we meet, I want you to know that this is what other students are saying. And then I just felt like, okay, it's not really worth it for me to meet with him and talk to him, because he's not really going to be open to what I'm trying to communicate with him. So I kind of gave up. I gave up on that. And at the end of that semester, I had left Shippensburg anyway. So I had hoped that it would continue to be an issue with the faculty or the faculty union. But I think when the individual person is not there anymore, maybe there's less of an impulse to kind of do something about this. So,
in one piece, The Guardian, you say classical Islamic art eschews representation and also eschews a sense of the artistic production, book, painting, building, as an object with senses of either linearity or completeness. Could you talk a little bit about whether or how this tension informs your work, and what are ways that creative Muslims work with these traditions?
Well, certainly as a poet, I feel like my use of language and my effort at building poems kind of works with more experimental modes of time and space. And my example is most recently my book, Bright Felon, which kind of sits between poetry, essays, and memoir. Is the story of my life that works in sentences, but it moves backwards through time, and even within each individual chapter, as it moves backwards through time, it skips backwards and forwards and brings things from later in the book, which is earlier in life, and earlier in the book, which is later in life. So it has a different, almost like a geometric sense, which is, you know, one of the classical forms of Islamic art: geometry, calligraphy, and architecture. But I also work on several projects at once, and lots of times ideas or even sentences and images move from one book to the other. And I write in multiple genres. I write poems, I write novels, essays, and sometimes texts that move between those genres, like my book Bright Felon and my new project, which is a book on Anais Nin, the 20th century writer. So in a sense, it's that idea of the shape of a book as a project that can move musically as opposed to, you know, logically or rhetorically. You know, what seems primary and primal to me at the core of any poem or novel or essay is that idea of the sentence, the line, the sound of language against silence, the way an individual works in the context of this sort of movement of creation. So I really feel like I'm guided by this idea of thought and breath, each being an involuntary reflex, reflex guided not really by intention, but by that. In Arabic, it's a word called ruah, and in Latin, spiritus. These are both words that mean both breath and soul.
I was just kind of curious if you wanted to talk about the title.
Well, the title Orange Alert comes from the essay Poetry is Dangerous, and it's this idea of Orange Alert as a heightened threat. And what the Department of Homeland Security already always announces when you're at the airport, and I travel a lot, is the threat advisory level has been raised to orange. So what's interesting about that is the verb raised, because I don't remember when it's been yellow coming raised to orange. It was yellow briefly after Barack Obama's election. But otherwise, I remember from 2001 always hearing the terror threat advisory has been raised to orange. They won't make it red because they don't want to have some panic, but they want to make it orange. They don't want it to be, we're not supposed to cool off, in other words. We're not supposed to put away our anger. We're supposed to keep it close enough so that we can, you know, act with aggression, but but far enough away that there's not general panic and we still, you know, shop. You know, what did George W. Bush do, like, the week after September 11th? He got on TV and warned us, told us all we had to keep shopping, you know, keep buying things and stuff. So it's sort of, it was just surreal, you know. So that's where Orange Alert comes from. But also the epigraph of the book tells the seven chakras, and the sixth chakra, which is the sacral chakra, which governs the emotions of joy and spirituality and creativity, is associated with the color orange. So the color orange is this color of joy, creativity, intellectual pursuits, all of that. So now it's the time. It's Orange Alert. It's time to be creative, joyful, mindful, compelling, engaged people, so we can start to turn the war machine around back into more human orientation.
Thank you so much, Kazem, for talking with us today. This has been very enlightening.
Thank you for having me.
We have been speaking with Kazem Ali, author of Orange Alert, Essays on Poetry, Art, and the Architecture of Silence. To learn more about our books, visit us on the web at press.umich.edu. This podcast has been brought to you by the University of Michigan Press, all rights reserved.